Welcome to the Impactful Innovators podcast series. This series is produced from the fall 2020 class at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship at RPI. This series highlights the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond. Today's episode will feature Selchuk Atli, class of 2009, is a founder and CEO of Bunch, a group video chat app designed for live mobile games. Selchuk is a graduate of Y Combinator, W14, an Endeavor entrepreneur, and a Fulbright scholar. In his 10 years since graduating RPI, he has built four companies and had three successful exits.
Thanks for having me. It's good to see you guys. What I wanted to do was kind of give you a quick overview of my adventures to date and basically go from there, open up the questions. I could kind of talk about like building startups and pivoting your startups and coming up with ideas and all that goodness. So I was at RPI back in 2009. After that, I basically created these four companies, one of which was a nonprofit, all of which exited. Right now, I'm currently working on this video chat application called Bunch. So quick story on my end is I'm Turkish. I grew up in Turkey. I went to Koç University for computer science real quick. And then after I was valedictorian, I got a Fulbright scholarship and went to RPI, did a master's in information technology over there. And then after Fulbright, they basically kick you out of the country and they're like, go back to your home country and teach the American ways to Turkish folk. And I was like, can I blog about it and post on Twitter and stuff? They said, no, go back. And I said, fine. So I did go back and started a company called Iletken, which was basically this like recommendation engine systems. And I like to consider this company the company that I made most of my mistakes on, so I could kind of learn a lot faster. One of the kind of thing. So what it was is basically we helped build personalization systems for folks. So, you know, when you go to Amazon, they say like people who bought this also bought this. Or when you go to Pandora or Spotify, that kind of gives like a personalized radio station. So one of the challenges of that is we didn't establish who our customer and market was. We're like, this technology is really cool. Let's basically build this technology for every application. And then we're like, we're trying to focus on e-commerce companies and telecommunication companies and news websites. And also the team wasn't technical enough. There was just one deep engineer and like it wasn't really balanced. But then I was like, hey, this whole recommendation engine thing is kind of like very 2000s because there's a lot of companies that does this stuff. Let's focus on social personalization for e-commerce companies. We were basically saying back in 2011, if you log into a website using Facebook Connect, can I learn a lot about you using your Facebook data to personalize your experience instantly without having to listen to click a bunch of products or buy a bunch of stuff to understand what you're looking for? We then pivoted that company to not recommendations, but advertising those recommendations. So essentially, we would work with really big online retailers like Zappos, and we would help them advertise all their products automatically on Facebook in the form of product recommendations. So it just solved a different problem for the same customers. And as a response to that, Facebook gave us an Innovation Award in 2013. We're like, this is one of the coolest products on our platform that's listed by advertising. It was good because we sold the company to Rakuten, which is like the Amazon of Japan. So then while I was building that company, I came up with another idea, which became my next company, Boostable. Again, in the advertising technology space, the picture that you see here is my co-founder and Paul Graham, which is the founder of Y Combinator. If you know Y Combinator, it's basically the incubator that launched like Dropbox and Airbnb and things like that. He retired after this class. So we were just like really lucky to have to be able to work with Paul Graham before he retired. And what we did with that company is we helped sellers on online marketplaces push a button and buy ads on Facebook. So the problem that I saw while I was building my previous company was we would somewhat easily be able to sell advertising to retailers like Zappos, But it was so hard selling advertising to online marketplaces like eBay or Ticketmaster or Eventbrite or Etsy, because if you buy something on Etsy, like $100 worth of products, Etsy makes $2 while the seller makes $98, right? But even though Etsy has all the data in the world to buy advertising and measure that advertising, they can't really buy it because they just don't make enough money to invest it into advertising. On the other hand, the seller makes a lot of money, but they have no idea how to advertise. They don't have the data to advertise. And even if they did, they couldn't measure the results because it's not their website. So we basically did this thing where we integrated with the marketplaces to give a one-click advertising solution to their seller base, which incentivized the marketplaces to promote our product, because if their sellers bought advertising, it was free advertising dollars for the marketplace. So when you think about it, it's like PayPal, but for advertising. So we sold that company to Metric Collective back in 2016, which was like an advertising roll-up here in New York. And then I joined 500 Startups, which is a VC firm. So I like to say I joined the dark side of the force and became an investor for a couple of years. We invested in a bunch of companies and stuff. Then I got bored of being an investor because I like building stuff more. So I started this thing called 500 Labs, which is what people call a startup studio. I think the name comes from movie studios, where just like a movie studio can produce multiple movies and kind of launch them. A startup studio can essentially run experiments for new startup ideas and turn them into companies. So that was my founding partner at 500 Labs. It's basically like an initiative that we did with 500 Startups. It's like a fund that where we invested in our own ideas, essentially. While I was doing that, I also started a nonprofit organization called Nomadic Mentors. It's like Doctors Without Borders for entrepreneurs, like Jason very succinctly. We connected entrepreneurs and successful founders who were willing to travel and mentor entrepreneurs around the world with the host organizations that would invite them. So we had folks like the CEO of Y Combinator and Ariel Zuckerberg and Sian Bannister and stuff. During this, like probably one of the most prominent mentor networks in the Valley that got acquired by The Family. It's not the mafia. It's a startup accelerator called The Family. And then one of the things I heard when I was building the startup studio 500 Labs from a lot of my VC friends is that most startup studios just become one of the companies that they're most excited about, which exactly happened in our case, because we had this idea for a bunch and we kind of built it and we tried it ourselves and we're like, this is so cool. Like, why don't we have this? Let's just stop experimenting and just focus on this company, which is what we did. So we raised about $28 million from investors like General Catalyst, London Venture Partners, Betaworks and stuff, but also almost every large game developer that makes multiplayer games in the world. And this is Bunch. It's a video chat and you just push a button to play your favorite games with your friends. It comes with built-in multiplayer games, as you can see here. So this is a trivia game I think that you guys played earlier. But there's a lot of really cool games called like Mars Dash, which is like Mario Kart with your friends where you get to freeze them and fly over them. You can play games, Draw Party, where it's like Pictionary with video chat. And you can also play your favorite games on the App Store, like Among Us and Roblox and Fortnite. So we're funded by and work with developers like Electronic Arts, Supercell, Ubisoft, Riot Games, Miniclip, Tencent, and stuff. These little game studios. And people like the app. They're like, this is Bunch is a miracle and stuff, which is kind of fun to read these things. It's a lot more fun than building advertising technology products, I can tell you that. We've been featured around, like Forbes wrote about us recently in our recent Series A article, and Fortune called us one of the 5 apps that are popular with Gen Z. And then I also am a singer-songwriter. You can listen to my band on Spotify and Apple Music and stuff. It's called The Hmms, because it's really difficult to yell it out in a concert. It's kind of by design. Like, you can't say, like, bring out the hmms. It's kind of hard to say. So that's like a quick overview of some of that stuff.
Well, we have a few more minutes. I'd love to hear a little bit about the model of startup success and finding other ideas that you mentioned about earlier in your talk.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Let me do that one sec. So this is a model that it got picked up by like VentureBeat and stuff like that. And I found it helpful when I was following entrepreneurs. So the model is called Pivot Pyramid. So basically kind of like, how do you pivot your idea? Because a lot of times, the idea that you start with is not going to be the idea that you find success with. Right? I think a lot of the skills is basically like, how do you mold and shape your idea to find product market fit. And that usually occurs out of a series of pivots, like some small, some larger. And I've pivoted a bunch of times in my startups too. Like what I did with, for example, SocialWire, which was called also Manifest Commerce, is we started with a recommendation engine that would show recommendations based on your Facebook information to something that advertised those products on Facebook instead of showing them on your sites, right? So it was a completely different problem for a similar customer using a similar technology, right? So what you want to do as a startup is like search for product market fit. And one of the things that people ask is like, what is product market fit? Like people say, like, if you have to ask, you don't really have product market fit, right? So what that means is like your product is working so well for the customer base you're targeting that you don't have to worry about finding customers. They just come to you. And the problem that you really have is like, how do I keep my servers up? Or how do I hire enough salespeople and stuff? And it kind of feels magic. Like it's basically like, how does it work? I haven't talked about this presentation in a long time. So what is the next slide? So ultimately, the way you get the product market fit is like doing a whole bunch of small experiments. Like it's not like one big pivot. It's not like you had a dream one night, you wake up, basically you knock the nightstand over and you're like, I have the idea. That's not really how it works. You basically make up tons of small changes and one of those things work usually. How many of you have heard like the term growth hacking? Like it's talked a lot about startups and stuff like that. So growth hacking is actually like a very minimal version of this, right? So growth hacking means like, let's try a bunch of little experiments and changing things. Let's have a hypothesis about like, this idea. Okay, if we did this, we're going to get a lot more users. You do it, you measure it, see if it works. If it's working, you spend more time on it, you scale it, right? So the whole thing about growth hacking is how can I come up with these little experiments that can potentially lead to growth? And assuming some of these are going to be successful, some are going to be failure. But when you think about a startup, the growth experiments that you can do are like tip of the iceberg. Ultimately, you need to constantly be experimenting with every aspect of your startup or your thesis to make sure that you have a thesis that maps perfectly to what the market needs. And a lot of times, unless you're Steve Jobs, you're probably not going to come up with it right away. One of the things that we put together at the time is this thing called pivot pyramid. By realizing that you're going to need to make changes across all these series of assumptions about your product, right? So what are some of your assumptions as a company? Because one of the things that Dave Muckler said, which is the founder of Fire and Startups, is a startup that is confused about who their customers are and how they're going to make money. So ultimately, you have an assumption on a bunch of those things, and you're hoping that your assumptions come true. So what are your assumptions about? They're about who's my customer? What is the problem I'm solving for that customer? What is the product I'm going to build to solve that problem for that customer? What kind of technology can I use to build a product that I'm talking about? And once I've had all the stuff, how can I get customers? How can I get users? And ultimately, the startup is like an ever-changing business plan across all these assumptions. And there's basically companies that pivoted in a lot of these areas. Like for example, Shopify actually pivoted who their customers were when they started. When Shopify started, they were actually selling snowboards online. And they were like, well, nobody wants our snowboards, but a lot of people like this e-commerce software that we built. So let's just basically sell our e-commerce software to people who need it. And they completely shifted who their customers were. Another type of pivot is like changing what your problem is. And this is I'll give you an company example of a Criteo, which is very similar to my company, where they started by building a recommendation engine for like online like websites. And they were like, you know what? Instead of recommending this product, let's start advertising them. So they basically, let's still help e-commerce websites, but let's not solve the personalization problem for them. Let's solve the advertising problem for them of bringing their customers back. Another one, like solution is like Meerkats. Like they basically were helping people get together with their friends when they're physically apart. And Meerkats' solution for that was like, let's have people go live when they're together. And they changed their product such that they would basically start a live stream on Twitter, which was like a change in the product that gave them product market fit at the time. And Facebook was an example of technology pivot, right? So for example, I don't know if you guys remember, but Facebook's initial foray into mobile was through HTML5. They were like, who needs mobile apps? We'll basically build like an HTML5 version of like Facebook on mobile and everybody's gonna use it. Nobody gave a fuck, right? Sorry for bleeping myself here, but for the users, you don't really care that if Facebook is built with C++ or PHP, you care about the product, but it can actually help kind of make your product work. And ultimately, it's product, like the last layer is growth. what are the things that you're basically changing, right? So growth pivot could be changing your pricing or introducing a new customer channel. Like for Airbnb, it was like when people post listing on Airbnb, they would automatically post it on Craigslist, right? That's not like a product feature. That's like a growth hack that leads to growth. What are some of the key takeaways from this model? And I'm going to wrap up real quickly. So if you're looking at this as a building or a pyramid from bottom to top, you want to experiment with things at the bottom less frequently, right? You can't change who your customer is every minute because otherwise you just get nauseous from building your startup. But then changing like the way that you get customers or changing your technology is a lot easier than changing a lot of these fundamental assumptions. Another one is changing something at the bottom leads to changes at the top, right? So for example, if you change who your customers are, you probably need to change the problem you're solving, right? But you can basically still solve a different problem for the same customer, right? Or you can change your technology without changing your product. But if you change your product, you probably need to change your technology. Another thing that I basically see a lot of times, it's a mistake with startups that were pitching me when I was an investor or like companies that I talked to is, and this is a mistake that I've done in my first company, is not starting with the customers, but starting with product and technology, right? If you're building a building, you don't start building the roof, right? You start building the base. And the base of every startup is who is your customer and what problem are you solving for them? So you want to always like start at the bottom. And technology, you'll just basically trash it and rebuild it a bunch of times. It doesn't matter because people get too stuck on technology. Like we're in the middle of changing our technology stack right now, right? Nobody cares, but like assume you're going to throw your technology. And another one that's important is if you choose a very large customer base, like that is like a very different, like not a very focused customer base, or like even worse, if you choose to focus on different types of customers at the same time, since everything that you're doing depends on your customer assumption, right? All your assumptions around your problem and your product and everything depends on who your customer is, you'll have to come up with different assumptions for each of those customers, right? Because you're building multiple pyramids at the same time. And what are you thinking, right? Because you're a startup, you're like two people and a dog, you're not going to build multiple pyramids, right? That's why it's important to start with a very refined customer segment that can get larger over time. Because a lot of really successful startups start by solving a really important problem for a niche customer base. It's a lot easier to grow your startup that way than basically, I'm going to build something that solves all the problems for everyone in the world. Like it's really difficult and you're not going to compete doing that against Google or Facebook. This is something I mentioned. Assume you're going to dump your technology because it's here. Nobody cares. Like ultimately, your users don't even see what technology you're using. And a lot of really successful startups have shitty technology or they basically redo their technology multiple times. All experiments must target growth in some way. So it's important to be methodical and scientific about a lot of your assumptions, but that's the model.
They're very interesting. I think that you know aligns with a lot of the things of the business model canvas that we use to teach entrepreneurship RPI, and right. But it gives a nuanced additional layer that really focuses on the customer that I think the business model canvas doesn't.
Yeah, it's and I very, think the business very, model canvas is like too static, right? It's I think it's like business model canvas is built for like MBAs who want to manage supply chains. And like what I realized in startups, like everything, every assumption you have will change at all times. So you're basically almost dealing with a multi-dimensional Rubik's Cube or chess or something. So I think the right way to approach a startup is not to have like a static business plan that you write once and put it on your shelf. It's to basically kind of continuously reevaluate your assumptions on every layer of your company.
So we have a question we've been trying to ask all the speakers of this series. If you were a freshman at Rensselaer today, what do you think you would be working on or what would motivate you to potentially consider as an entrepreneur?
I think I would try to find the people that I'd want to build things with because I think like a lot of times like team is a lot more important than ideas. And most startups fail because of like founder conflict or like team issues. So I would look at the time that I'm spending to identify really smart people to do stuff with. I think that's important because you don't want to basically meet your co-founders at like a startup dating thing. You want to basically have spent time with them, gone through issues and challenges. So that's, I think, one thing. And the other one is just follow your curiosity, right? Basically find stuff that you're excited about and spend a lot of time in those spaces. And also don't commit to a company or a project before you know it's working, right? Because one of the kind of, I think, awesome things about being in college is like you have optionality, right? So just work on cool stuff with no expectation, and hopefully some of that stuff turns into interesting things. And then that way you don't basically overcommit to an idea that's not going to work.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Impactful Innovators podcast series. Be sure to continue listening as we explore more of the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. Thank you again to the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube, share it with a friend, or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond.